Jayesh.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, guys, to another week of
the Killer Babes of Killer podcast. I'm Kirby.
I'm Katie.
And we already told you what we are, so we're good. How was your week?
So, did you do anything cool? No? Okay. We'll just jump right into it. I've explicitly been told to cut down on the chit-chat.
From who? Who? Spill the tea.
I'm not going to get them in trouble with you, but some people said that not everyone likes to chat. I'm just saying.
Who?
Who? I just also don't have anything to say this week. All right. We're just going to jump into it then.
Yeah.
This is episode 35.
Wow. Yeah. Y'all, we're 5 episodes away from being done with 40. Season 2.
Yep. Well, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, after this one, we'll be have 5 left.
Yes.
I always get confused, like, a number minus a number is different than...
What?
Because 40 minus 35 is 5, but including this one, 6 episodes.
This one doesn't count. After this one, we'll have 5 episodes left.
I know.
Yeah.
That concept is always just lost on me, though.
All right, all right. You know what? Okay. I don't get tablespoons, so we've all got our things.
What do you mean you don't get them? Like,
I just don't get them. Like, there's teaspoons and there's tablespoons. And, like, mine aren't, like, etched. Oh, my God. So, my mom actually, like, really quick before we start, speaking of tablespoons, my mom was, like, she came over and she cooked the other day with me. And we made, like,
really nice.
Yeah, we made, like, this recipe that I love. Like, I literally beg for it for, like, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Like, it's just really time consuming.
What is it?
It's meat buns, but you have to make the bread yourself.
You would like meat buns.
They're so freaking good. They're like sweet meat inside of like a rolled bun that's buttered. Oh my God. It's amazing. It's so good. So anyway, like we're making them and it takes a really long time because you have to make the bread and then you have to make the meat.
From
and
you scratch?
Gotta, yeah, girl, with the yeast. Heck? We had to let it rise and like watch it. But anyway, okay, unrelated, super unrelated. But she opens my cabinets and she's like, oh, like you don't like the tablespoon set or like the measuring cup set you got, like I got you. And I was like, what are you talking about? What set? She's like, oh, I bought you this beautiful copper set from Alaska. What? And I was like, I never got that set. I was like, you're tripping. Like, I have 2 plastic sets.
Mama?
I have 1 set from Target that was like $4. And I have 1 set that came with like an overall set that we bought.
I know if you had copper measuring cups, you would have them out displayed.
I would have them out on my tabletops. And I would make sure everyone who walks to that door hears a little cling, cling. Cling, cling. I might even use it as
cooking,
a bell.
Bitch.
Yeah. So I was like, excuse me, like, where are they? Like, they're mine. Like, where are they?
That's pretty ungrateful of you.
And she was just like, oh, they must have gotten lost in the travels. And I was like, what? So, yeah, that's the story of how I don't have tablespoons. But anyway, okay, so here's why I can't decipher tablespoons or teaspoons. Because the ones that I have, like the plastic, we've sent it to the dishwasher a couple times. So it smudged the little thing. And so like you have to look very closely and kind of pull like a braille. Like you have to rub your finger and see if it's longer or shorter. The longer one is TBSP. And the shorter one is just TSP. So you have to like take them out at the same time and like rub it. So that's why tablespoons and teaspoons just...
They're not on a ring. Like your tablespoons are in one ring.
I took them off.
Are another ring.
Yeah, I just took them off. I thought it was nicer than a ring, but I now get the concept of the ring.
The difference between them. I mean, the teaspoon ones are going to all be all the smaller ones.
Yeah, yeah,
but
like,
if you don't have the number on
in the
it,
heat of the moment,
you know,
it's like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. You know,
like, can you see the number if it's like a third or a half?
Like, kind of, but so yeah. Carry on with the story. Just know that I'm missing out on my copper teaspoons.
I don't even know how we got to the tablespoons. I don't know what
I don't think we've started the story yet, but let's get there.
Well, how did we talk about tablespoons?
Oh, I know, because you were, we were talking about the episodes, and we all have our numbers problem, and that was mine.
Oh, you have tablespoon problems. You also have, like...
I have a lot of problems, but that's going to take way too long to get into.
Right, I'm not even going to bring it up.
So anyway, we have 5 episodes left. We've deduced the math for you, and at 40, season 2 will be a closer. We're working on a really exciting closer for y'all, so stay tuned. A couple of things. Couple of things have been in the works. You know, a couple things. So, you know, stay with us. Stay strong.
Big, big plans. We're
hopefully they all go through.
Just kidding. All right, let's just jump into it.
Yeah.
I will say this episode is pretty sad, so
it is.
It's not gonna be like lighthearted, just so you guys know.
It's a serious one.
It's a serious one. I mean, last week we did The Haunting in Connecticut, which some would say is serious. Maybe not so much.
But
that was on the paranormal side, but this is like a true crime side, so
yes.
Mm-hmm. We also again are cheating just a teaspoon, if you will.
Or a tablespoon.
Well, I would just say a teaspoon because it's okay. Like a pinch. All although, right. It's kind of a lot. It doesn't only take place in New England, and only a little bit of it takes place in New England, but that's good enough of a connection for us, so.
Yeah, and we set the rules around here.
That's right.
So, Kitty, take it away.
All right, folks, this is episode 35, and we are talking about John Jubert. So, John Jubert, born John Joseph Jingleheimer Schmidt. No, I'm just kidding. He was born John Joseph Jubert IV. So he's an American serial killer known as the Nebraska Boy Snatcher and the Woodford Slasher. Jubert was convicted of the murders of three boys throughout Maine and Nebraska. So John Jubert was born in Lawrence, Mass. on July 2nd, 1963. He was the oldest of two children. He and his sister were raised by parents Joseph Jubert. So, John Joseph Jubert was raised by Joseph Jubert, a cook and a waiter, and then his mother, Beverly Jubert, who was a bookkeeper. He was a bright child, apparently. He began reading at 3 years old, borrowing books from his public library at 5 years old. He was later found to have an IQ of 123, which signifies above average intelligence, from a psychology test at the Topeka Psychiatric Center. Jubert's parents divorced when he was just 8 years old, and he stayed to live with his mother, whom he greatly resented. He and his mother moved out of the house into a rundown apartment together. He saw her as controlling, and he kind of grew to hate her over time, which is where the resentment comes from. His mother forbade him from seeing his father, part of the controlling aspect. During school, Jubert was bullied for having a relatively small build, a little bit of a weakling, and this would continue throughout grade school all the way to high school. You could say he was an outcast. This affected his academic and social well-being, resulting in kind of a problematic childhood. Well, actually a very problematic childhood. He decided to join the Cub Scouts, perhaps a way to make friends or perhaps just a way to forget about his hardships at school. Around this time, Jubert began having the kind of sadistic fantasies that would consume the rest of his life. According to three psychiatric reports prepared about Jubert in 1984, his earliest sadistic fantasies began at around the age of just 6 years old. These fantasies revolved around murdering and cannibalizing a neighborhood girl who babysat him at the time. To one psychiatrist, he described having nothing personal against the girl, seeing her as, quote, just someone to kill. Soon, his homicidal fantasies began progressing to imitating murdering strangers on the streets. Specifically, he had visions of tying and gagging anyone who would resist him.
At 20 years old, Jubert joined...
No.
Too far?
Yeah.
Oh. In 1974, at the age of 11 years old, he and his mother moved to Portland, Maine. There was a job for bookkeeping, and so they settled into a two-story home in a middle-class Oakdale neighborhood. School, unfortunately, did not get better in Portland. Jubert confessed at the age of 12 to being homosexual, which only led to more bullying from his peers. From ages 13 to 16, Jubert's violent fantasies became a reality. At 13 years old, he stabbed a 9-year-old girl, Sarah Canty, in the back with a pencil. He admitted to feeling sexually stimulated when she cried in pain. But he got away with it, so the next day he slashed another girl with a razor blade while riding by on his bicycle. 3 years later, he attacked an 8-year-old boy, Chris Day, nearly strangling him to death. This pattern indicated a more serious attack with each occurrence, but still, Jubert was not getting caught.
After that, he began using a knife to slash or stab people, but he never killed anyone. I don't get how he was not caught. I feel like little kids tattle very easily. Like, why would you not go to your mom? And wouldn't your mom notice that you were stabbed?
Hey, the 70s and the 80s were a weird time. I mean, I agree. I don't know how the kid wasn't like, John, stab me.
Or maybe they did and the mom was just like, listen, I'll put him in timeout or something.
This is what happens when your kids. No, that would be a bad mom.
What?
I don't know. I picture mothers as back in the day being like harsh.
Or doped up cleaning the house all day. That's what I picture. I picture him being like,
don't tell
me. Well, like, really, like, I don't know, like those weird commercials where they're just like, I've been at home baking all day.
Oh, yeah. But like robots.
But like very weird. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like it was a different world back then. Yeah. And maybe, I don't know, people put up with a lot more, I think.
Yeah, it was definitely not today, because if you even touched a kid today, there would be like juvie courts all up on you. You'd be on like Maury or like Judge Judy or something. I don't know. I feel like it wouldn't fly today for sure. But I mean,
I don't think it should ever fly, stabbing someone in the back with a pencil.
Well,
or,
you know,
or slashing a boy with a razor blade. Like, this is not any of it's okay.
Razor blade, I'm on board with. But a pencil, like, did it go all the way through? Did the tip just break off because it was a lead pencil? Like, did it really hurt him? I don't know. It's a pencil.
I don't know. And, like, one isolated incident might be, like, okay.
But I feel like this is the whole school.
But if you start to, yeah, if you start to notice, like, all of this and it's all pointing to one kid, then I feel like it should start getting more serious. I think maybe they just couldn't pin him to like all of this, and so they just
didn't
realize it was as big a deal as it was. I don't know.
I get the feeling that he was a bully and people did not want to tattle on him, maybe. I don't know. Who knows? On January 24th, 1980, Joubert attacked a 27-year-old student going to the University of Maine. He stabbed her in the stomach and critically injured her. On March 24th, 1980, Joubert attacked a 9-year-old boy, Michael Whittam. He cut the boy's throat, but miraculously, the boy survived. And in 1981, Joubert graduated from Severus, right?
I don't know. Cheverus?
Severus High School in Portland, Maine. He went on to begin college. So, again, like, these are three, like, pretty serious attacks now, and just skates by.
Yeah. I don't know how he went unnoticed, but he did.
I really don't know.
So, we're still in Portland, Maine at this point. In the evening of August 23rd, 1982, around 8 p.m., an 11-year-old boy named Richard Stetson, who he went by Ricky Stetson, he went out for a jog on the Back Cove Trail, a biking and jogging path in Portland, Maine. As the night drew on and Ricky had not returned home, his parents began to worry and called the police. Ricky and his family lived in a working-class section of Portland, Maine. A little background on Portland, because we haven't really given, we've given some background on a few towns, but I don't think Portland yet. It's a coastal city, obviously, in Maine. It's actually the most populous city in the state of Maine. The greater Portland metropolitan area is home to over 500,000 people, more than one-third of Maine's total population, making it the most populous metropolitan area in northern New England. Marine industry still plays an important role in the city's economy, with an active waterfront that supports fishing and commercial shipping. As a primary summer vacation destination, tourism also plays a major role in the city's economy. It's just a cute little city. Y'all should definitely go.
Have you been?
Yeah, well, we went together.
That's right.
All right, so we're talking about Ricky Stetson. The day after he went missing, Ricky's body was spotted by a motorist in a nearby ravine on the side of USI 295. Ricky was partially undressed as if his attacker tried to, it looked like his attacker tried to undress him. It was clear that Ricky had been stabbed and strangled. The autopsy later revealed that the boy had not been sexually assaulted. However, there were bite marks found on various parts of his body. Oddly, examiners noticed that these bite marks appeared to be covered up in a way with slashes from a knife running over the marks from the bite. This was not something examiners had ever seen before.
it was a very unique signature to that killer that he had left behind. To investigators, the whole crime scene reminded them of a similar series of knifings that occurred in the Oakdale section of the city 2 years prior. Around that time, a 9-year-old boy, Michael Whitham, who we briefly mentioned, this is kind of what happened. He had an encounter with what they called the Oakdale Slasher at the time. Michael was called into a wooded lot between a few homes by a man he did not recognize. The man asked Michael a few questions, including his name, age, and where he lived. When the man dismissed the boy and Michael turned to leave, the man pulled out a knife and cut Michael's throat. Fortunately, he was able to get away in time, but the deep cut on his Michael's throat was nearly fatal and required 12 stitches to close up. All Michael was able to provide for a description of the man was that he was a white male in his late teens or early 20s. When investigating the murder of Ricky Stetson, witnesses told police that they saw a young man riding a bicycle right behind Ricky during his run. The description of this young man matched the description Michael gave police, but to be fair, those descriptions were that of a young white male in the Portland, Maine area, so that really doesn't narrow anything down at all. The police initially thought that they had the right guy and arrested 24-year-old Joseph Anderson for the death of Ricky Stetson. However, after spending a year and a half in custody, the suspect was released because analysis found that the suspect's teeth did not match that of a bite mark that was found on Ricky's body, like we mentioned earlier. Besides the unmatched teeth, police became pretty certain Anderson was not guilty of Ricky's murder after hearing about an eerily similar crime that had just occurred in Bellevue, Nebraska.
At 20 years old, Joubert joined the Air Force in 1983. He was stationed at the Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. It was in the force that he met Eric Braden, who became a very close friend of Joubert's. A friend is something that he never really had before, but of course, everybody always longs for a friend. In that same year that the two met, unfortunately, Eric passed away. Joubert gained a really great friend and lost him, and it caused him to fall into a deep depression. Some believe that this is what triggered Joubert to take his second victim. And on Sunday, September 18th, 1983, a 13-year-old boy, Danny Joe Eberle, disappeared while delivering the Omaha World Herald newspaper in Bellevue, Nebraska. Danny's brother also delivered newspapers in town, but hadn't noticed anything weird that day. However, Danny's brother also noticed before that occasionally a white man in a tan car would follow him around. Danny's bicycle was found outside of a house that would have been only the fourth stop on his route. Besides the bike and the rest of the newspapers he was slated to deliver, nothing else was found. There were no signs of a struggle. Danny's disappearance triggered a 3-day statewide search. After 3 days, his body was discovered in a patch of high grass beside a gravel road. The road was about 4 miles from where his bicycle was found. His clothing was stripped down to his underwear. His feet and hands were bound by rope, and his mouth was taped shut with surgical tape. There were knife marks dragged across his body, suggesting he was tortured before he died. A significant star-shaped pattern had been cut into the boy's chest. Stab wounds indicated Danny was stabbed 9 times, but again, similar to the case with Ricky, there were no signs of sexual assault. Since the crime included a kidnapping, it fell under the jurisdiction of the federal government, so the FBI was sent in.
Police turned to FBI behavioral analyst Robert Ressler for a psychological profile of the killer. The killer's signature of biting had an impact on the killer's profile that Ressler was making. He was compelled to bite his victims, but possibly ashamed of it, given that he covered up the bites with knife wounds. Now, this got us a bit curious on the act of biting from a psychological standpoint. We've seen this kind of behavior before in other cases, and it begs the question, what is the mindset behind a killer who bites? So, we did a little research. And we took some excerpts from this article called Forensic Implications of Biting Behavior, a conceptually underdeveloped area of investigation that was published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences. So again, these are all excerpts from that journal writing. In the analysis of homicide cases that involve human bite marks, profilers would consider the number and location of the bite marks and the estimated time the bites were inflicted in relation to the victim's death. The determination that the bite marks were inflicted pre-mortem, anti-mortem, or post-mortem would be viewed differently. Bites to the breasts, genitals, back, neck, and face would be interpreted differently than bites to the hands or the forearms. Within the literature on forensic profiling, the issue of signature behavior provides an intuitive link to a more conceptual understanding of biting behavior. Signature behavior refers to aspects of a perpetrator's criminal repertoire that appears to transcend his modus operandi. MO, that's what MO stands for. Modus operandi. The MO is what the offender does to affect the crime. The signature, in a sense, is why he does it.
Very interesting. Furthermore, it would seem reasonable to assume that a signature behavior stems from either sadistic or cannibalistic intent when bite marks are present consistently across a series of aberrant crime scenes. Conversely, in serial offenses where bite marks do not present consistently, it is more likely that the biting behavior was driven by an impulse display of anger or frustration. In a report produced by the National Association for the Education of Young Children, biting is construed as a normal developmental phase insofar as 1 out of 10 toddlers and 2-year-olds demonstrate biting behavior. The report claims that it is possible to identify the kind of biter you are dealing with and classifies these biting types as follows. The experimental biter is driven by a need to touch, smell, and taste other people in order to learn more about their world. The frustrated biter is driven by a lack of the skills necessary to cope with social situations, such as desire for attention. The threatened biter tends to be overwhelmed by their surroundings and bites as a means of regaining control. And then you have the power biter, who is driven by a strong need for autonomy and may resort to biting in order to feel a sense of personal power. According to Campbell, most biters will tend to outgrow the behavior as they develop new skills for coping with stress and feelings of anger. This may help explain why the developmental critique of biting ends at childhood. However, what are the consequences if the child is unable to fully develop these negating skills? Could childhood biting behavior manifest itself in adulthood?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because I think we all know like biting is something that kids go through sometimes.
Yeah, definitely common in school.
Right. It's like a phase. And it makes sense that there are different reasons for the biting. And then it also makes sense that normally that kind of behavior goes away over time because you learn
different coping mechanisms.
Right. And you kind of learn like, no, adults and grownups do this first. They don't just resort to biting. But if something kind of went wrong in your developmental
stages
of life, of growth, maybe yeah. You didn't gain those, and that's and by no means does this explain why this killer was a biter or why other ones are, but it's just an interesting thing to think why that behavior could still show itself in adulthood. So the article itself discusses how the concept of biting in the forensic psychology world is one that is still very much underdeveloped. It suggests that much more research should be done around the topic because it claims that like there's hardly any other research on the topic. So it's kind of one that we don't know much about still. But still, the act of biting undoubtedly influenced a profile that was being built by the FBI during the search for the Nebraska killer. Analyst Robert Ressler was also using other evidence to build the profile. Because the body was found so close to the road, Ressler suspected that the killer was slightly built and probably not strong enough to carry the body very far. The proximity of the body to the road also suggested to Ressler that the killer was inexperienced. He was most likely paranoid and scared to be driving around with a body in his car, but yet not sophisticated, quote-unquote sophisticated, enough or knowledgeable enough about the area to dispose of the body effectively. Perhaps not the killer's first murder, but likely his first murder in this area. Could be significant. The rope that was used to bind Danny's hands and feet was of particular interest to the investigators. The rope was sent to FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. The outside of the rope was common white nylon, so it like I was watching a video and it looked like extremely common rope. Like, you'd see it and you'd say, that's a piece of rope. But when they cut the rope open, the inner core was very unusual. It contained 24 different types of fibers and 106 different colored yarns all inside the same strand of rope. So the rope was then sent to the National Cordage Institute, a trade association of all rope manufacturers in the U.S. Who knew that existed?
Yeah.
There's an institute for everything these days. But the institute's most experienced experts also had never seen this type of rope before, so they were kind of at a loss. At one point, investigators thought they had a lead in the case, but the man did not fit the FBI profile, so he was released. Apparently, there were numerous known pedophiles in the area, all of which were questioned, but there was a lack of evidence on all accounts, so the case just kind of went cold for a while. During this time, the town of Bellevue, Nebraska, was in a state of panic. Parents were keeping a very close eye on their children. Despite the precautions, not even 3 months later, the unthinkable happened yet again. On December 2nd, 1983, 12-year-old Christopher Walden disappeared in Papillion, Nebraska. Christopher lived in Bellevue, but went missing while he was walking to school. About 8 blocks from his house, Christopher was at a four-way stop when a young man came up and forced him into his car. Police searched for Christopher for 3 days in sub-zero temperatures. It was a group of pheasant hunters that actually found Christopher's body. They had stumbled upon a snow-covered figure in a wooded area while out on a little pheasant hunt. The area where Christopher was found was only about 3 miles from where Danny's body had been found. Similar to Danny, Christopher was stripped to his underwear. He was stabbed and his throat had been cut. Most similarly, the same telltale signature of a star-shaped pattern had been etched into his body. Dissimilarly, though, Christopher had not been bound. His body was concealed a little bit better, and he was thought to have been killed immediately after abduction. There were 2 sets of footprints in the snow leading to Christopher's body, and only 1 set of footprints leaving. In this case, witnesses also claimed to see something else familiar, a young white male in his early 20s. He was seen walking with Christopher on the walkway near his school. Witness descriptions allowed police to come up with a composite drawing, which was distributed around town.
Ressler continued to build his profile of the killer. He thought the killer would likely be involved in some type of activity that involved young men, like coaching sports or Boy Scouts. He also believed the killer had read detective magazines or done research on other crimes. The killer was probably aware that his teeth imprints were similar to a fingerprint, and that it could be traced back to him, hence the gouging of his bite marks. Investigators also asked a woman who claimed she may have witnessed the abduction of Christopher Walden to undergo hypnosis in an effort to get more details out of her. She remembered a few more details from the hypnosis, like seeing a man the same height as Christopher, seeing a brown car, and a partial license plate number, but this still didn't get the detectives anywhere. Finally, they got the break in the case they were looking for at the expense of a woman named Barbara Weaver. Barbara Weaver worked in a daycare center. Barbara was well aware of the crimes that had been happening in the area and claimed she would go to church and pray that there was something, anything she could do. On January 11, 1984, Barbara looked outside and noticed a strange car. Inside was a man wearing a ski cap who looked similar to the forensic sketches she had seen on the news. Because Barbara was a badass vigilante, she ran over to a desk and started writing down the license plate of the car as fast as she could. And as she was doing this, the man from the car came running into the room and threatened her with a knife. Barbara was able to run past him out of the center and next door to the pastor's house. And because of that, she was able to provide police with a full license plate number. Police tracked the plate to a 19-year-old enlisted man stationed at Offutt Air Force Base. His name, as we now know, is John Jubert. They learned John was a maintenance mechanic in the radar unit, and confirming Ressler's theory, Jubert was an Eagle Scout and assistant scout leader for a local troop. They found hair that matched Danny Eberle's DNA on the floor of Jubert's car. Also, in their car, they found a knife, tape, and a rope. Now, for those of you paying attention, this is a significant find because this rope was identical to the extremely rare rope that was used to bind the hands and feet of the boys. Jubert had no idea the rope was so rare because he had been given it years earlier in the Boy Scouts.
Joubert was arrested and sentenced to death. No one ever quite got the answer as to what drove Joubert to kill. When one investigator asked Joubert if he let him out right now, would he kill again? Joubert replied, "Yeah, I probably would. I suppose I can't help myself." On September 9, 1984, the judge sentences John Joubert to die in the electric chair. By 1987, he's still fantasizing about death and murder, even though he claims to be in control of his thoughts. In 1990, he was convicted in Maine of the murder of Richard Stetson, his first victim. He spent his time drawing on tissue paper his fantasies of violence with the boys. In 1995, he appealed his death sentence in a Nebraska court, and the court reviewed the case. He argued the fact that the court's wording on the aggravating factors was unconstitutionally vague. The court upheld his sentence. On the evening of July 16, 1996, John Joubert was moved to a death watch cell in the basement of Nebraska State Penitentiary. Joubert spent most of his final hours with his pen pal turned fiance, Teresa O'Brien, which is a topic we've discussed before. The pen pal turned fiance of murderers in jail is a concept I'll never understand.
But we did go over the psychology of it.
Yeah, briefly.
Mm-hmm.
In something.
Oh dear.
Oh, wait. I mean, I guess it doesn't really matter.
We went over it in previous episodes.
We went over that in a pretty recent episode. So I'm not going to go into it again. But there is a lot of research out there about these things because it happens all the time where a killer goes to jail and he talks to a bunch of women via letters and someone becomes his fiance. It's baffling. Anyway, back to John Joubert. He ordered a last meal consisting of pizza with green peppers and onions, a giant bottle of Coca-Cola, and strawberry cheesecake. Very interesting. Very interesting. Didn't know they also got dessert with it sometimes. That's crazy. We were just talking about, though, like, that doesn't happen anymore. And also, yeah, the whole concept kind of is confusing to me.
I would love to know, you know, how that came about.
Yeah, last meal. It must be, yeah, I don't know, some, like, weird old standard. Because it just kind of seems now, like, okay, you're going to give them cheesecake and then you're going to electrocute them. Like, that just seems like cheesecake gone bad, like, to waste, you know?
So, what's the point of this death row ritual? This is an article from BBC News. BBC News. Okay. So it says, this one's talking about the state of Texas that had just ended the practice of offering death row inmates their choice of a last meal. And then it also goes into a little bit about what a killer's choice of food says about his state of mind. But
it basically really just says what he likes to eat, I feel, but okay.
Yeah. Basically, the ritual captures the public's imagination because the activity of sitting down for dinner is one that Americans with no experience of prison life can relate to. And this is coming from Deborah Dino, a professor at Fordham University School of Law in New York, who is an expert on capital punishment law. Quote, it brings us back to the fact that this is a human being who will not be having any more dinners like we do, end quote. And then there's drama associated with it, like this is the Last Supper. Maybe it has a Christian connotation. You know, Texas gave it up because they thought there was more to worry about than getting a prisoner the last meal.
I agree. It seems like an extremely outdated idea.
Yeah. I mean, the origins of it are pretty murky. I mean, in France, the to be executed were given a glass of rum before they were executed. In the 16th century England area, the inmates shared a meal with the executioner. So
I don't like that.
We kind of like Americanized, you know, all of these things about why they get them. So
I can see the glass of rum because you kind of want to almost give them like a sedative. So they're not like, because obviously they're, I would think they'd be like nervous. But the whole meal, that just seems wacko.
Yeah. This guy, Robert Walsh, who wrote an article about the history of the last meal, is a compassionate act or an undeserved reward. He thinks that it has Christian roots. And then believes that, you know, it is kind of like that last nice act that they'll ever get in their life. So, yeah, and it goes back all the way to medieval Europe. So the background is a little murky on that one, but
there is back. I mean, it makes sense. Like, it wouldn't just, I don't think somebody would come up with that idea out of nowhere. It seems like something we've been doing for a long time.
It also seems
like something that, we should stop. So, whatever, though. He got one in before they stopped that. And this was in 1996. They were filming it. So, he got his strawberry cheesecake. And then that evening at around 12:10 a.m., the curtain over the witness room was drawn and the execution chamber parted, revealing Joubert standing in front of his execution chair. The warden said, quote, "Inmate Joubert, do you wish to make a final statement?" Joubert replied, quote, "I just want to say that, again, I am sorry for what I have done. I do not know if my death will change anything or if it will bring anyone peace, and I just ask the families of Danny Eberle and Christopher Walden and Richard Stetson to please try to find some peace and ask the people of Nebraska to forgive me. That's all," end quote. That's very interesting that was his last.
You think so?
Yes.
He apologizes. He wraps things up. He acknowledges who he's killed.
It's very interesting that I feel like it says a lot about him in that he, because even given that he's apologizing, he was asked before, like, did you learn your lesson? Would you kill again? He was like, honestly, I probably would. Like, it's something I don't think I can control. Like, he seems very,
like, self-aware.
Not self-aware.
Yeah.
And he's not just like, I'm crazy. They deserve, like,
he's
crazy. But, like, he's like, yeah, that shouldn't have happened. But, like, there's something wrong with me. So, I don't know. It's interesting.
It is interesting.
Also, like, some killers try to be weird and, like, say something that they think is, like, wise. And
oh,
it's like,
yeah.
Okay, shut up. You're gonna die. Just don't try to be, like Mr. Riddles right now.
Mr. Riddles. In his last moment, he looked towards Teresa O'Brien, who was sitting in the witness room. As they made eye contact, he smiled and mouthed, "I love you," as a guard put a leather mask over his face.
Yikes, that's not the kind of love story you want, folks.
No. No. So at 12:14 a.m. in a nearby control room, the executioner activated the transformer and turned a rotary switch, which sends 2,450 volts of electricity up your body for 8 seconds, and then they deactivate the current. They wait 5 seconds, and then they activate it again. A 22-second jolt of electricity at 480 volts. After waiting 20 seconds, the cycle is repeated, and it sends more jolts of high-voltage electricity through the chair. Finally, at 12:17, the chair was deactivated. Joubert's lifeless body slumped in his seat, his face concealed by the leather mask. At 12:22 a.m., at the age of 33, John Joubert was sentenced to capital punishment and executed by the electric chair in the Nebraska State Prison in Lincoln on July 17, 1996. He was the second-to-last person to die in Nebraska's electric chair. Less than 12 years later, the state of Nebraska outlawed electrocution as a means of capital punishment, and the chair was dismantled forever.
It's an interesting fact. So, yeah, right around the turn of the 21st century.
Yep. Which is around when all the states kind of started to.
Yeah. It is. I mean, listening, I didn't really know that was like the process of doing it. Like, it's this jolt for this many seconds and then this current for this many. It's like, oh, there's like a whole, like,
it's like a science towards it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't, it's interesting that how did they figure that out that that was the best means of doing it? It also seems like, if they have to do it that many times, like, obviously it doesn't work. Like, just after once, then it seems like a torturous way to go. Like, you're not going to die right away. It's going to take a few sessions of this, like, electricity to kill you. So it's definitely went to the wayside because it was argued to be inhumane, which now I can kind of understand why.
So, quick trivia question. How many states in the U.S. still hold the death penalty?
I think, I would say like, Okay, my guess would be like 15.
No, more.
Oh, it's a lot. Wait, like half? Like 30?
Yeah, 30 really? States still have the death penalty. Yep. Mm-hmm. And it looks like there are none in New England.
That zero. Makes sense, yeah.
New Hampshire, my bad.
Oh, that does make sense.
yeah, that is the closest one to us.
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh.
Yeah, interesting.
Yep. But none. Is it, what about electric chair, though? I don't know if any state that still has a death penalty has electric chair.
Yeah, I don't know. They don't. They just list it by state on this.
Okay. This is according to Wikipedia. As of 2015, the only places in the world that still reserve the electric chair as an option for execution in the U.S. are Alabama, Florida, South Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. Arkansas and Oklahoma laws provide for its use should lethal injection ever be held unconstitutional. So it's like plan B.
Interesting.
But so that's six states where it's still legal to do.
Six out of the 30, I guess.
Yeah, and they're all...
And that was 2015, so I guess it could have changed.
Yeah, maybe. I think probably in a lot of those states, like, it's a big topic and, like, might be going through things where people are trying to get it outlawed, but yeah. I think those are still the states that are still legal. Interesting to note that they all are southern majority.
That doesn't surprise me, though. States.
No. Nope, but... That's a fun fact. Not
well. Not that's a trivia question. Not, but, yeah, that's all we have for you.
Yes,
I've never heard of him before.
Me neither.
And it still like flabbergasts me that again. We talked about this earlier, but he went unnoticed for so long and had so many instances where like, mm-hmm. I think he should have gotten help. I think he needed help. I think he needed help. And then, boom, didn't get help because he couldn't be stopped. But, hey, I was not back around there at that time, so
yeah,
I don't know how it went down.
So, the fact that his parents were divorced, and I think his mom was
working hard.
His mind was kind of neglectful, so maybe that has something to do with it. And then, obviously, the fact that he killed in one place and then went to another place and killed, that makes it harder to solve, I feel.
True.
Until they find those, like, very
rare pieces of rope.
Signatures.
What are the odds, too, if he didn't use the rope that was given to him, like, and just used the local general store's rope?
Yeah.
They might not have found him.
I know. Yeah. So, that's all, folks.
That's all we got.
You can follow us if you want. You know the links. If you don't, go to another episode and find them.
It's always at the end of our little podcast.
It's pretty much just Killer Babes podcast on everything besides Twitter, which is Killer Babes Pod. So yep. You can find us. If you have any questions, problems, concerns, ideas for new episodes, you can also email us killerbabespodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
And next week, maybe we'll bring you something that's a little bit more lighthearted. We try to switch it up.
You gotta stay tuned.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. We will see you guys next week for episode 36.
36.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.